Okay, today's shir is dedicated in the memory of Sarah Bat Chaim Lishoshana Tova, whose yahrzeit is on the 12th day of Adar. The person who asked me to dedicate this is this young girl's grandfather, who occasionally comes to the shir. He was here last week. You'd probably recognize him if you saw him. And this shir is the memory of the granddaughter who died as a young girl, and so all the things we say should be li'ilui nishmata. He's one of these people who tell me, I don't believe all of them who tell me, I believe him, but some people tell me, we quote you every Friday night, we quote you all the time. I mean, that may be, but the people who say, yeah, well, I bought you, we learned your book together, I would have sold much more books if every single person who... Who claims this?
But we do quote you.
Ah, yeah.
And we do buy your books.
You do buy your books. I better be careful what I say then. Here is the goal for today, is to speak about the Parsha as minimally as possible, to make reference, of course, that we're in Parshat Zachar, and to deal with Parshat Zachar a bit. And we're right before Purim, so maybe something having to do with Purim, which using Parshat Zachor is fairly easy, but I kind of get the suspicion that one of the reasons Chazal instituted Parshat Zachor and all the Parshiot is in order to deal with, dealing with Parshot like this one, with all the details and so on. But what is this Parsha about? Last week we learned about the idea of building a Mishkan, and it dealt with a lot of the materials in terms of the structure. This week it moves over to textiles in the making of the clothing for the Kohen, which means, it could be, I would have suspect, I never would have thought about it at all. You know, what kind of clothing do you need to wear to serve as a Kohen, and is clothing actually important? So I guess the answer is yes, the clothing is important, and Chazal tell us that. Chazal tell us to what extent every single element of the clothing creates its own type of forgiveness and spiritual dynamic, and the clothing really is, in fact, quite important. Vata krev lecha et Aaron achicha ve'et banav ito mitoch bnei Yisrael lechahano li Aaron Nadav Avihu Elazar v'Itamar bnei Aaron. So Aaron and sons are being invited. So as I've pointed out on numerous occasions, the huge metaphoric elephant in the room is going to be, has the sin of the golden calf taken place yet, or is it not taken place yet? If the sin of the golden calf has taken place, then the selection of Aaron and his children to be the Kohanim really is quite interesting. And perhaps then we have to reevaluate the entire sin of the golden calf in terms of Aaron's quote-unquote reward, which comes after it. Although we should be careful, because there maybe other elements which are not exactly in a word which follow. But still, the selection of Aaron is interesting, and the selection of Aaron was not obvious. The reason why I say it was not obvious is that, as far as we know until this point, and there will be various verses later on in the Torah that will tell us this clearly, that prior to the selection of the Kohanim and Shevet Levi as a whole, it was the firstborn, the Bechor, who were the ones who were selected to serve. Which actually means that the Bechor, the firstborn, served at a couple of times. We don't necessarily know who served in Egypt when they brought the Korban Pesach. It is possible the Bechor in each family was the one, which is really far more interesting in terms of the contrast between the firstborn of the Jews doing the Korban Pesach versus the firstborn of the Egyptians who are then going to die that night. So I'm saying that then just becomes that much more interesting. So that's one point. The other thing is that presumably they also served at Har Sinai. That at Har Sinai there is a Mizbeach which is built, this Korbanot which are brought, so presumably that was again the firstborn who were working then. But finally, the other time that the firstborn would have been working as well would have been during the Cheta Egel. So that's one side of it. If I follow the Ramban's world, whereby everything is in sequence, so therefore the selection of Aaron takes place prior to the sin of the golden calf, and then the question will be, well, why exactly does Aaron retain his position at that particular point? So as I said, those issues, that's really, in terms of the background, what is most interesting. So also the contrast between the firstborn versus the so-called Kohen is one of the things we need to keep in mind. So let's press on. Well, in this week's other Parsha, in Parsha Zachar, we find that the Jews are attacked by Amalek. So presumably, or at first glance at least, this has absolutely nothing to do whatsoever with the parsha itself. Right? Here we're talking about things in the Mishkan, firstborn, replaced Aharon Kohen. The one thing I want you to think about then is this ability of replacing someone, of somebody who could have been selected as a firstborn and then have been the Kohen, but to be replaced by somebody else. That may actually be far more intriguing than we imagine. Parshat Zachar itself, well, there's actually two Parshat Zachars. There's the one that we read, which is in Devarim, and then there's the other one, which is in real time, which is in Bishalach. If we look at source number 10, Zachar Eit Asher Asalacha Amalek B'derech B'tzeitchem Mitzrayim. We should remember that which Amalek did to us when we were on the way when we left Egypt. Ashakor Chabaderech, where they happened upon us along the way, V'yizanev Becha Kol Hanecha Shalim Acharecha. Now that is not such an easy phrase, that one. So I'm leaving it out. V'tayef V'yageya. And you were tired, exhausted, V'lo Yirei Elokim, and did not fear God, which is a dangling something, and it's a machloket in the Mechilta, whether not fearing God is something which refers to Amalek, did not fear God, or it refers to the Jewish people not fearing God, and it could be read either way. But the thing that I want you to recall right now is that it says, V'atayefi yageya. You were tired, you were exhausted. There's also this implication of being weak, which is a possible read on the word nechashalim, which does not say chalash there, but there are those who read it as chalash, as perhaps we'll see. But the reason I want you to keep in mind about all of this, because what is really the origin of the Amalek story? I mean, all stories have origins to them, correct? There's an origin to this. There's a background to this. There's a greater context. So the background to Amalek's hatred of Bnei Yisrael, or the attack that Amalek has against Bnei Yisrael, against the Jewish people, goes back to two individuals who lived long ago, and that was Yaakov and Esav. And Yaakov eventually gets known by his other name, Yisrael, and morphs into this Bnei Yisrael, who are now the people we're speaking of, while Esav has numerous descendants, but one of the descendants, the one who seems to harbor his same murderous intentions, which he had said, I'm going to kill Yaakov, that would seem to be inherited by his descendant Amalek, or the people who become Amalek. Amalek is the son of Eliphaz, together with a woman named Timnah. They were not married formally. She was a Pelegesh. I don't know what kind of impact that may have had on Amalek's own self-understanding. Timnah, the Gemara says, the most fascinating thing. It says that she had wanted to convert, and she approached Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and they all rejected, and the Gemara said it was a mistake. That rejecting her is what caused Amalek. So that's really interesting in terms of blaming ourselves for the issue. But maybe this is not a political statement, unless you choose to interpret it that way, that maybe we need to be a little bit more accepting upon people who want to join us rather than always looking for other issues. So I'll just point it out. The Gemara is actually critical of us, of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, for not accepting Timnah, which again is a most interesting comment. But this, as we said, all goes back to Yaakov and Esav. And on the one hand, we know that there was a struggle of Yaakov and Esav, which was in utero, which itself, you know, the Midrashim embellish a bit to tell us what exactly was the background of this. But the first time that we sense that there is difficulty once they're in this world goes in source number 2. And the young men grew up, and Esav becomes a man of the field, a hunter, a man of the field. And Yaakov becomes a simple man, a man of the tents. So I want to stress something about this as well. We're told in Pirkei Avot the world exists on three things, on Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasadim. The commentaries see that as being represented by the three avot, that Avraham represents Gemilat Chasadim, and Yaakov represents Torah. Yaakov is an Ishtam Yoshev Olim. The Olim is understood as being the Beit Midrash, and he's somebody who is on his, I don't want to use the word natural, but the essence of Yaakov is more one of a person of Torah, which actually, but then by default, says Avodah, then becomes Yitzchak. So what makes Yitzchak into Avodah is that he himself, we find him praying, you know, in the field, but more importantly, he is the one who was supposed to, let's do this more delicately. The consecration of the Chanukah Bayit, the consecration of the place that would one day become the Beit HaMikdash, is created by Yitzchak. Let me make another observation. Avram, many times in his life prior to this, builds a Mizbeach, builds an altar, and he never puts anything on any of the altars that he builds. The first time he puts something on an altar is when he puts Yitzchak on the altar. The beginning of Avodah, the beginning of service of Korbanot, is represented by Yitzchak. Of course, then Yitzchak gets replaced, as it were, and then this other animal takes the place. But that is the first Korban, and Yitzchak's essence then becomes one connected to Avodah. But I want to point out again, Yitzchak is Avodah, both in terms of his service and also in terms of the creation of Avodah is somehow wrapped up within this spiritual personality of Yitzchak. Esav, as the hunter and as the individual who is adept in the field, had a certain potential, which I'm just going to hold on for a second and read on. V'yav Yitzchak et Esav kitzad b'fiv, and Yitzchak, and if you will, I will say, represents Avodah, he appreciates Esav. Rivko hevet et Yaakov. V'yazid Yaakov nazid v'yavo Esav minasedeva hu ayef. And the most important word that I want you to note there is that he is tired. He comes from the field and he is tired. If you never noticed before the connection between the state of the Jewish people prior to the attack of Amalek, where it says Ayef v'yageya, so you say, okay, who is Ayef? Okay, Esav is the one who is Ayef. So how exactly does this work? Well, apparently, when we become tired and we become like Esav, and now we have to question, is this being tired? Is it a physical weariness? Is this an emotional? Is this spiritual? Are we tired of our role in the world? I mean, what kind of exhaustion is this? But nonetheless, there is a direct parallel between our being tired and Esav himself, and he's tired. But what happens then? And I want you to notice the word Adom, because the redness over here. Ki ayef anochi, because I'm tired. So that's repeated. Alkein, kurashmo Adom. V'yom Yaakov mechmar ki yom et bechor tchali. So sell me the right as the firstborn. V'yom Esav ani anochi lech lamut. I'm going to die. V'lam ali zeh bechora. What do I need it for? To be the firstborn. Swear to me today, and he swears. And he sells it. And Esav then perhaps is sated physically, but it says, Vayivez. He detests the Bechora, which means he didn't think he made a bad deal, quite the opposite. He thinks he made a wonderful deal because he got rid of something. But what is it that he got rid of? Rashi writes, and this is what I don't want you to miss, because Rashi is extremely clear. V'yivez Esav, he'ira katuv al risho, shebiza avodato shel makom. Rashi understands quite clearly that what it was that he rejected was the rights of the firstborn, which meant to be the Kohen, and therefore to serve God. So I just want to go back and read Rashi's sensibility back into the text and maybe see something which I hinted at, which I'm not sure how clearly you heard it. Yitzchak's love for Esav is because Esav is supposed to be the Kohen, and the Kohen is the person who's supposed to then be doing the Shechita and doing all the work in the Beit HaMikdash and his hands full of blood and so on and so forth, which is not a very nice image. But now, when you look at Esav and you see this person with their hands full of blood and so on, and you see somebody who's morally reprehensible, Yitzchak sees within him, Yitzchak who represents Avodah, he sees him as being someone who will be the perfect person to go and serve inside the Mikdash or the Mishkan. Let me make another observation. There's a Gemara at the very end of Masechet Shabbat. It's on page 156. It tells us that it talks about planetary influence. It talks about different signs. If anybody ever wanted to consider Judaism's understanding of what could be called astrology, and those interested will know the Rambam is quite uninterested and the Ibn Ezra is quite interested, and there are many scholars who fall on both sides. But here you have a Gemara that talks about planetary influence and says anybody who's born under the sign of Mars is the red planet, what was Mars called in Hebrew? It's Ma'adim, but from the word Edom, because it was understood to be the red planet. I assume that is visual from the eyes. I don't know. I said I assume. I don't know. I don't know what I'm looking at. I mean, come on. You can see it's red. So that, and therefore it's called the red planet. So therefore the Gemara says anybody born in the red planet is going to become somebody who is going to be a spiller of blood. And the Gemara says, hold on, not so quick. Let him be a shochet, let him be a moel. Which means it seems to be that that kind of person will have some type of a preset in terms of their personality or their soul, but it says this is not predetermination. You can then use this in a positive way, negative way. Of course, for those of you who are interested being right before Purim, one of the rabbis says, what are you talking about? I'm born in Ma'adim, his name is Rabbah, and Rabbah says, no, I don't go killing people. Well, incidentally, Rabbah's the one who we're told had the Purim Seudah with Reb Zerah, and he's the one who slaughtered Reb Zerah. So he never killed anybody till he drank a little bit of wine, and then his inner personality seems to come out. So that Gemara really is quite interesting in terms of Rabbah and in terms of the Purim story. And as I said, you need at least something for Purim. But let's continue. The Yivez Esav et Bachora, Rashi says that he what he detested was this idea of becoming a Kohen. So let's understand this. On the one hand, what we should appreciate is that the Gemara is telling us is that Esav has rejected a role in the spiritual world or a spiritual role in this world. You can say that however you prefer to say that. He does not want this idea of spirituality. He does not want to serve God, and therefore he detests the role that his father has given to him. As you may have heard me say before, I think that when Yaakov then enters in, and again, I want you to keep in mind, because this really is true within the Midrashic sensibility, when Yitzchak calls Esav to come in and to serve him, there is very much an idea of Kedusha taking place, and some of the Midrashim understand this as being a precursor to the Korban Pesach, which is going to be brought. Some see it as a precursor to the service on Yom Kippur. We, by the way, obviously today, when I say today, I mean standing a couple days before Purim, we obviously prefer Yom Kippur because of this very strange analogy between Yom Kippur and Purim. But one of the issues that connect the two is on both of the days there is lots which are taken. One is called a Pur and one is called a Goral. On Purim, of course, it was Haman who did the lots, but on Yom Kippur, who's the one who does the lots? The Kohen Gadol. But what is the lots about? The lots is about is between two Seirim, two goats. Okay, parenthetical point. Seir is the place that Esav lives. Seir somehow connected to Esav. These two goats, we're told, need to look as similar as possible. They need to be the same height, the same size, the same everything, which the one word which is missing is the word they need to be twins. Rav Huttner in his Pachad Yitzchak says, yeah, they need to be twins. And who, of course, represents twins? Well, that's Yaakov and Esav. And one is LaHashem and one is LaAzazel. So therefore, one is whatever you want to translate Azazel in. Well, we would say, well, that would be more connected to the Esav power in the world, and the other is Yaakov, who then enters into the place which is holy. Which means that this dichotomy on Yom Kippur between the two Seirim of Yaakov and Esav is not so far from the Purim story of the Yisrael and the Amalek and so on. And especially when you realize that there's a backdrop to the story, and that is the clothing. It's the clothing of the Kohen, which, by the way, that's where we started, just in case you don't realize. It's the clothing of the Kohen, which were then misappropriated by Ahasuerus. And when Ahasuerus asks Haman, you know, if the king likes somebody, give him the clothing. So which clothing is the king's clothing? The king's clothing is the clothing that he took from the Kohen. But of course, the wonderful irony of the story is that clothing ends up back with Mordechai. So therefore, this question of who's going to be the Kohen and who's going to serve, even if you thought it was completely disconnected to the Purim story, it was right there, you know, you're staring at it from the very beginning in terms of the Purim story, and ultimately, who is going to be the Kohen. I may actually have a source about this for you. If not, then I will read to you a... You know always that I have secret sources I don't share with you. Yeah. The beginning of Megillat Esther says that Baharoto et Osher Kavod Malchuto ved Yikar Tferet Gedulato, that he wants to show off all of these things. Now those words of Osher, his wealth, Kavod, his honor of his kingship. Yikar is something of value. Tiferet is something of beauty, and so on. So the Gemara points out, Baharatot Osher Kavod Malchotom, Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina, this is Gemara in Megillah and Daf Yud Bet Amud Aleph, Milamid Shelavash Bigdei Kohuna. This teaches us that he wore the clothing of the Kohen, K'tiv Hancha Yikar Tiferet Gdulato, because here it says that phrase, Yikar Tiferet Gdulato, K'tiv Hatam, and it says in our parsha regarding the clothing of the Kohen, it says, Lichvod Ule Tiferet. It says the clothing should be, again, of honor and of beauty, and therefore it says that these things refer to the same point, and that's the clothing that he was wearing. So this clothing, therefore, becomes a little bit more interesting. Let me, though, continue with the source number four, the Gur Aryeh. For those who don't recall, the Gur Aryeh is the commentary of the Maharal on Rashi. Right, it's a commentary on Rashi. Rashi just now said he did not want to serve as a Kohen, so the Gur Aryeh, the Maharal, says it. He ira katuv de bizayon ze hu belibo. That's something which he held in his heart. Vimkena katuv meid beruch hakodesh arishato. So therefore tells us it attests to his wickedness. So let me just point out. There's another thing that it tells us that was in his heart. What else did he say in his heart? That he wanted to kill Yaakov. He didn't articulate that. How in the world Rivka knew that? Well, Rivka was very adept at hearing things that were said, even though they were not necessarily said physically in this world. And this he says to himself. Note the Baal HaTurim, and then we'll put this together. Vayivez Esav, Vayizav Be'enav, Gabi Haman. Oh, sorry, let me go to the beginning of the line. Vayivez Bet. So what is the Baal HaTurim saying? That this word, Vayivez, only occurs twice in Tanakh. One is by Esav, and once is by Haman. So those of you who think that's an accident, can I absolutely assure you that that's not an accident? I want to make sure that you really understand this. The author of Megillat Esther wanted to very clearly associate the behavior and the thoughts of Haman together with the thoughts of Esav. And where does Esav say it? Where does Haman say it? Vayizav be'enav gabei Haman. So go and look at source number 6. Vayivez be'enav l'shloach yad b'mordechai levado. That Vayivez was that he found it detestable only to kill Mordechai when he can kill the entire people. This was to him an absurdity. So now you just have to ask yourself, so are these two terms connected? And of course the answer is yes. So I'm going to say it again, that there is the Vayivez here, there is a Vayivez there. That's what's in his heart over here. And when Esav wants to kill everybody, that's what's going to be in his heart. And therefore, we would be correct in assuming that the hatred that Haman has somehow goes right back to this question of who will be the one who will be the Bechor, or the one who will serve, or the Kohen. So I'm just saying that's for it's a little more interesting when Haman wants to get these clothing. So I'm saying Pshat is, he's a megalomaniac with personality, narcissistic personality disorder, who wants to try to take the power and the kingship. But I'm saying the subtext that Chazal put into it is that there's also the issue of the clothing of the Kohen Gadol as well. The Chizkuni says something, which when I read it, I thought was wonderful. I still think is wonderful. But then I said, hold it. You know, is this him or is he getting it from somewhere? So I had to work a little bit hard. I'll show you exactly how I worked. So listen to what he says. Source 7. V'yivez Esav et ha-bechorah. Ad shelo nivchar Aharon l'kohuna haitav odah b'vchorot. So he just puts that line together. He explains the Rashi, and it was very clear that's what Rashi had in mind. Amar oto rasha. Ma'ni melachlech yadai b'korbanot. Why should I get my hands dirty with all the blood from the korbanot? Which is really interesting, because of all people in the world, who finds having his hands full of blood distasteful. So it's apparently, he only finds it distasteful when it's a korban. Which means Esav, Edom, has no problem with killing. And it says, Ahu dichtiv ki dam saneta v'dam yirdafecha dami levadam korbanot. Chizkuni says the things that he hated. Now, he's actually quoting a verse. So the verse that he's quoting, we'll see in a moment, But he says that what is the blood that he hates? The blood that he hates is the dam mila. He hates the idea that of brit mila, and he hates the idea of korbanot. And that's really interesting in terms of the Gemara that I mentioned to you earlier. What do the Gemara say that someone should do if he has an affinity to blood, right? The Gemara did not say become a mass murderer. The Gemara said you should become a moel or you should become a shochet. Right? You don't have a fear of blood. Blood is not disgusting to you. This is something that you're, or become a dentist. This is, sorry. If you like giving pain, okay. I'll stop. If a person has this kind of, you know, inner world, the Gemara is saying, become a moel, become a shochet. And over here it says, is that no, he found it detestable, brit milah, to be a moel, or the korbanot, to be a shochet, and to be involved in the avodah of the Beit HaMikdash. And that's really interesting, because it's saying is that Esav was not willing to use his potential in this source of holiness. And therefore, part of what I want to try to understand is Esav's orientation towards holiness. Before we read the Midrash in number 8, so what it's based on is source number 9, which are verses in Yechezkel. V'yi dvar Hashem elai lemor, ben adam, sim panech al har Seir, v'yinovei aleha. You know, pay attention to this place called Har Seir. We all know who lives in Har Seir. Who's that? Seir is connected to Edom, to Esav. V'amarta lo, ko amar Hashem elokim, hineni alecha Har Seir, place will become destroyed and desolate. You had hatred forever, which means your treatment of Jews throughout history has been one which God says is unacceptable. That I'm going to, again, the punishment here will take place with blood. Right? And that's the verse which was again quoted by the Chizkuni. So, of course, what I then tried to understand was, okay, so what was he doing here? And again, I just want you to understand, I don't care if it's Rashi, I don't care if it's Ibn Ezra, Ramban, the first thing you always do is they quote a verse, they make an interpretation of the verse, you always need to go back and find the Chazal that they're getting it from, because most of the time what our classical commentaries are doing are quoting Chazal, sometimes very creatively, but they are quoting Chazal, and that's how I found source number 8. So what I did is I looked up the verse, I found the verse, and then I looked up where the verse was quoted in Chazal, and that takes me to number 8. Which actually tells us the whole story about Kahuna, which really just as easily could have been a comment on this week's Parsha. But of course what we're going to like about it is that it connects the Kahuna back to the Yaakov and Esav story. Umalki Tzedek Melech Shalem. Now if you remember, one of the things that he does is that he serves God. Real bona fide kuhuna only begins with Aaron. Was this man a kohen? Mashu omir kan vu kohen mipnei shehaya makriv ka kohanim. Meit Shem umasra la'avraham. So Shem dies, who is connected to Malki Tzedek, and he passes it to Avraham. V'chi Avraham ya bachor? Was Avraham a firstborn? Elam nesha yet tzedek nimsara lo b'chora v'kriv. Because he was righteous, he's the one who then obtains this, the right to serve as a Kohen. V'kriv shenemar v'yaleu la'ola tachat b'no. And of course, note, the korban that Avram brings is only after Yitzchak. It's on the Makom HaMikdash. It's where the Beit HaMikdash will stand. Meit Avram u'masra li'Yitzchak. Amad Yitzchak u'masra li'Yaakov. Of course, by Yitzchak, it didn't actually bring an example, which I hope you appreciate. But it says, nonetheless, that was pressed to him. And then it goes to Yaakov. V'chi Yaakov b'chor haya? Did Yaakov really have rights to become the Kohen? Elishat motzei shenatla Yaakov min Esav b'arma. He took it from him by being sly. Amar lo michra kayom et b'chorotcha li. Atzavor shema alchinam ama Yaakov l'Esav shuyim kor et b'chora? Love. Elisha Yaakov mevakesh la kriv v'lo yachol m'pnei shelo ya b'chor. Yaakov had a desire to serve God. Yaakov then is the joke. He wants to become a Kohen. Why? Well, because his father was a Kohen, his grandfather was a Kohen. But he's not a Kohen because he's not the firstborn. Amar Esav, mani mevakesh min habachora zot. But Esav responds and says, what do I need this for? So that verse that was quoted by Yechezkel says at that moment, it was regarding that moment that Yechezkel said his prophecy regarding Esav or Edom, v'omer lo im lo dam saneta v'dam yir dafecha v'chisoneya Esav et hadam. Did Esav really have a problem with blood? Hare kama tzadikim harag, hare kama chasidim harag. V'hu omer im lo dam saneta v'dam yudrfecha, elo amar lo im lo dam korban saneta. The blood that he hated was the blood of serving God. Shri abachor v'charot makrivin, because he was the firstborn and the firstborn served. L'fichach v'dam yirdafecha. Therefore the blood is going to pursue him. Bato sha'a kevan shalakach Yaakov et abachara hitchil makriv shenemar v'yomer lukim el Yaakov kum alei beit el v'asei sham mizbeach. And Yaakov therefore takes this bichora. So this point of the Chizkuni that Vayivez Esav et Bechora was really, you know, and his read of the book, of the source in Yechezkel was asking, hold it, did he have a fear of blood? No, not at all. He only had a fear of blood when it was not to his direct benefit. When it was serving God, that was something that he was not interested in at all. So again, let's now try to catch up what we're up to. Esav makes some bad business deals along the way. He gives up the Bechora. There was another thing that we can debate how much could have or should have or would have been his, and that's the land of Israel, which is connected to another point. It's connected to something else with Avram, and that is the Brit Bein HaBetarim, the covenant. But the Brit Bein HaBetarim, Avram is given, again, the land of Israel, but told that there is a detour on the way to the land of Israel, and that detour is going to go through Egypt and go through servitude, and only after the servitude is over, then you can make your way to the land of Israel. So apparently, the attitude of Amalek is, or Esav, let's start with Esav, complete disinterest in any kind of long-term investment. That's a really bad idea. Actually, long-term investments are very good ideas, yes. It's the people who, you know, move by every single, respond to every single little movement of the market who end up losing lots and lots of money. Yeah. Little movement. It's the people who have long-term investment strategies do well, which is really Yaakov. We learned that from Yaakov. His long-term investment strategy is a 400-year investment that, yeah, we'll take the servitude, but we'll take the land of Israel. And now, as soon as the Jewish people did the servitude part, suddenly Amalek shows up, okay, we'll take the land of Israel now. Thanks, bro, right, for doing that part of it, and now we're going to go and be the beneficiaries of the rest of this covenant, of this Brit Bein HaBetarim, which, again, keep in mind the term Brit Bein HaBetarim. So that's why Amalek comes and attacks us along the way. Yeah. Okay, so just a couple things to be careful about, and something which, you know, I've said many, many times. When Midrashim talk about Esav, we need to be careful. Are they talking about the biblical character, or are they talking about Roman Christianity? When you read a Midrash, Kama Tzadikim and Kama Chasidim, are they talking about something which happened in that literal Esav's life, or are they talking about the Crusades and the pogroms and you know, what metastasizes into a Holocaust, of course, with the Chmelnytsky massacres along the way, and the amount of the Tzadikim and the Chasidim that were killed all along through history. Which means I think Chazal see within the individual biblical Esav, they see everything which comes out afterwards, which in a sense is the worst face of Christianity in its ongoing war, historical war against Judaism. So that's really, you know, to a great extent, what that Midrash is doing and saying, you know, what was really the distaste that they have? Well, the distaste they had was real service of God, but killing, that was never a problem. So as I said, it's very interesting to read it in, but there's another element that I want to mention in terms of Esav, Amalek. Look at source 17, because this is the other Parshat Zachor. V'yikra shem ha'makom Masah Meriva. You know, that's when they were fighting regarding water. Al riv b'nei Yisrael v'al nasotam et Hashem lemor hayesh Hashem v'kirbenu im ayin. They're the ones who tested God by saying, is God among us or no? When the Jews get tired, and now I'll just read into it a little more, when they get spiritually tired, when they begin to doubt God, I mean, essentially, that's what Esav really does. It's not significant to serve God. If you really believe in God, then how is the service of God not something significant? Which means when we read the description in Parshat Zachor in Devarim, Ata Yef Yagev Lo Yirei Elokim, and as I said, that's a big question, who Lo Yirei Elokim refers to. Again, Mechilta has two opinions on this. The Rishonim go two different ways. So Lo Yirei Elokim, he didn't fear God. Well, it's really easy to read that into the Jewish people. Why? Because it says that you questioned if God is with us or not. It's also, by the way, very easy to read it into the attitude of Amalek, because that's also where Esav is, which means, what is the dominant issue over here? Is it that we got tired and therefore like Esav? Or we also, meaning got, we got tired, that we question God and therefore are like Esav? Esav is somebody who does not fear God and therefore they have no interest in the service of God, but they do want to take any, you know, benefits that can possibly come of it. So again, the description which leads up to Parshat Zachor in Bishalach is, I think, quite interesting. Let's go backwards again. When we read source number 10, again, Parshat Zachor, and the phrase that I had skipped before was V'yizanev b'cha kol hanecha shalim acharecha. You look at 11, which is the Chizkuni. Tell me if I ever get it wrong, because I have two different sources to sets over here. Chizkuni writes V'yizanev b'cha radaf achar oto shayu b'zanav hachayil, that they chased after those who were at the very end of the encampment, or even the soldiers, as it were, those who were, you know, the hangers-on at the very, very end, those are the ones who were easiest to attack. Ibn Ezra writes, V'zavim v'cha, karet zanavcha, v'hima nechashalim acharecha, shelo yabahem koach lelechet. So they went after the weak. I do want to stress that Rashi says that they went after the spiritual weak. Those that the cloud, as it were, the protective cloud, expels them, and those are the ones who are there susceptible. Within the description of the expulsion is those who served idolatry. They were kicked out. So I need to either say or say again or say again and again what the implication of Rashi's understanding is. These are the people that the Jewish community expels. Actually, it's even stronger than that. These are the people that God expels. They don't have the protection that the cloud gives to most of the people. So we're supposed to remember Parshat Zachor. We're supposed to remember how Malik attacked us when we were weak. What is, and it's interesting, we focus on every word and we listen. In some shuls, they'll have the one Bal Korei. Maybe in Israel, you'll have one who's Ashkenaz, one who's Sephard, and one who's Yemenite. I don't know if any shuls take out multiple Sifri Torah, because that's probably more important than the other things, but I didn't say that out loud. And they'll read Zecher and Zecher and so on and so forth. By the way, unquestionably that the correct text is Zecher, but unquestionably Sfardim can't say Zecher. I don't say can't, they don't. There is no Zecher. They read Zecher as Zecher, which is very funny anyway. So, but we go and read it twice. And I most likely, well, no Rishon ever did that, and most likely no one ever did that before the Mishnah Berurah. But we're very careful, because our sensibility is this is the one reading which is on a Torah level. But what about the content? The content is we remember what Amalek did to us. What did Amalek do to us? They went and attacked those who were susceptible. Why were they susceptible? Because they were weak. But we understand they were spiritually weak. So now, very simple question, what do we do with those who are spiritually weak? So do we kick them out of the house? Do we then say we don't want them in our neighborhoods? We don't want to even let them in our shuls because they embarrass us. And we can go on and on and on about how we don't want them over at our, you know, they can't be there for Shabbos because they may not keep it exactly. They can't be there. And I can go on and on and on. Or do we remember, well, that's what Parshat Zachor is, to remember that we went to war in Parshat Zachor against Amalek to defend those who were spiritually weak. So that's what Parshat Zachor is. I'm saying at least according to Rashi. So it is absolutely fascinating that we completely miss the message of what Parshat Zachor is, but we're very careful about reading every single word with hypersensitivity. What about the content? The content is that Parshat Zachor teaches us that we need to have an exaggerated sense of defense of those of the Jews who are spiritually weaker than us and make sure that they are well protected and taken care of, and those who attack them, we need to make sure that we protect them from those attacks. That's what Parshat Zachar is. I don't know what else to say, but that's at least Parshat Zachar according to Rashi and numerous other commentaries. But Rashi says something over here in context, which is, if you're familiar with it, it's one of these things that you probably say, I have no idea what to do with that. And that's what I want to try to do today, is to figure out what to do with that, which we have no idea what to do with. And let's read Rashi in source number 13. V'yazanev b'cha makat zanav. So again, look at the phrase itself in the pasuk. It says, "Asher korach b'derech v'yazanev b'cha kol hanechas shalim acharecha." Rashi says, "V'yazanev b'cha makat zanav." They struck an appendage. So again, till now, the appendage was that other part of the Jewish people who were sort of the ones who were hanging on to the people. But Rashi says, no. Chotech milot. They cut off an appendage of the Jews, namely the Brit Milah, v'zorei klapei mala, and then they threw it back to heaven. So this is, quote, whoever put that note into Rashi said, take a look at the Tanchuma. So you will look briefly at the Tanchuma in source number 15. V'yazanev b'cha hika otam makat zanav. They hit them in quote unquote the zanav. V'atya ki had amar Rav Chanina bar Shikla. Me'ayu beit Amalek osin. What did Amalek do? Chotchin milotein shel Yisrael. They cut off the Brit Milah. V'zorkin klapei mala v'omrim. And they threw it back to heaven saying, b'zeh b'charta? This is what you chose? Havi l'chamasha b'charta. Here, God, you can have it. So let's pause for a second, because this is probably one of the more bizarre things, which is why I would assume they don't bother teaching this, because you have to have some kind of idea what in the world they're talking about. A bunch of things come to mind. One thing is that part of the background of our whole story is the Brit Baina Batarim. The other thing about the background of our whole story is that one of the elements that makes Avraham, is the Brit Milah, right? You have a Brit Milah, then you get your new name. Avram's name is Avraham. And it is the definition of what a Jew is in the time of Esav. So it's very interesting that this is what Esav and then Amalek are rejecting. But where in the world do we see Esav have any trouble with this? Well, we saw one thing. We saw one midrash. Again, we did not know at the time that was significant. And that was, oh, Esav, you have this ability to deal with blood. You're not afraid of blood. Don't be a hunter. Become a mohel or become a shochet. So you didn't realize at that time, or become a mohel or become a kohen. You didn't realize at that time that the mohel part of it was really more important than you realized. And over here, we're saying, no, that there was this war against Brit Milah as well. Just as an aside, I mean, how many times in history has there been a war by various non-Jews, sometimes Jews, against Brit Milah? On the other hand, Brit Milah is the one thing which absolutely, without any kind of justification or understanding, you know, on my part, completely so-called, and that's why I have to say so-called, secular Israelis continue to, on the most part, have Brit Milah. But then again, for the most part, they light Shabbos candles and they make Kiddush and they go to shul, although they don't go in. They stand outside shul on Yom Kippur and they have a Pesach Seder. I mean, I just don't like the terms of so-called non-religious. I think that that we get stuck in terminology and we're very, very silly when we deal with our terminology. Actually, the percentage that keep kosher is also probably which is unexpected. Without picking on any denominations who live in America, I do question those who are religiously affiliated in America, how many of those things they keep compared to the quote-unquote secular Israelis. I think that including not working on Shabbos, by the way, I think that the numbers may be a little surprising. But when we hear this thing about Brit Milah, it really becomes interesting. I mean, the other thing, just connecting Brit Milah and Shechita, is these are the things which, of course, the enlightened people in Europe have attacked and will continue to attack. So I'll remind you about something which Rabbi Soloveitchik said, perhaps quoting someone or not. And one of the times, for some reason, I have a recollection of him quoting Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. I do not know. I did not find where it is in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. But I know I did hear Rabbi Soloveitchik say this. And it was essentially, if you want to know what's important in Judaism, what really has holiness, then you just have to figure out what upsets anti-Semites. because they have this incredible capacity of identifying holiness. So if they have a problem with Shechita, you know it's important. They have a problem with Brit Milah, you know it's important. They have a problem with Jerusalem, you know it's important. They have a problem with Israel, you know it's important. Very, very easy. Just read anti-Semitic newspapers, see what upsets them, and now you know how you should set your agenda and what's important for us to keep. It's just absolutely simple. But then when you go back to, again, I'm saying modern times, Shechita and Mila, and you go back, oh, Esav doesn't like these things, and Amalek attacks Brit Mila, I'm just saying it's just so much more interesting not taking this exclusively on a literal level, but therefore on this other level as this basic identifier of Judaism, but also there's a war against God going on over here. And it's a rejection of holiness, which means by taking the Brit Milah, as it were, and throwing it back to God and saying, here, take back what you've chosen, saying, I reject the concept of chosenness. I reject the concept of holiness, which means, is this such a terrible surprise that he detests this? And I'm saying, again, that becomes the whole background of our story. I do want to, as I said, point out a couple of more things which may or may not be connected. The parsha, we refer to this as Parshat Zachar. So to what level was there either a subconscious or a conscious connection between Zachar and a Zachar, which means maleness, as it were? And just in case you think that this is my total imagination taking place, let me point out something which, if you never knew this Gemara, this is a very interesting Gemara for many, many reasons. It is in source number 14. Gemara Baba Batra on Daf Kaf Aleph. I do want to warn you about something, and that is, just like the Sefer Torah doesn't actually have Nikud Dats, the correct way of pronunciation within it, neither does the Gemara. So in this case, I just want to be completely straightforward. I added the Nikud over here. If you want to know how I did that, there's actually a website. Anybody wants to know it, you'll email me later, and I'll show you how to do it, but you do have to make decisions on each word. Are you right? Are you not right along the way? So it could be I made mistakes. So just, but not only did I make mistakes, there's also editorial issues, decisions you have to make, because you can read this text more than one way. Rav Dimi Minaharda Omar, he said, Motvin didayik velogaris. The question is, when it comes to a teacher, what's really important? Is it important that the person has more knowledge, or is he more careful? Should I say that again? Is more knowledge important in a teacher, or more care? Is it the amount of what he knows, or how careful he teaches what he knows? Care versus amount of knowledge. Shebeshta kevin da'al al dichtiv, ki sheshet chadashim, yoshav sham yoav, v'cho Yisrael ad hichrit kol zachar be'edom. So of course, we're happy that we have Edom over here, and we have Yoav, who is a general, and he goes and he wipes out over 6 months. By the way, that Nikud is the Nikud of the Pasuk itself, so that was easier. And he wipes out all of the males of Edom. Kiyatelah kameh de David, when he was the general of David, when he comes in front of the king, David, Amarle, he says, my taima avaratachi. David says, why did you do this? Amarle, see the lay is wrong? There shouldn't be anything under the yud. Amarle, it shouldn't be a kamatz there. Okay, you have to fix that. Amar le dichtiv timche et zachar Amalek. He says, because the pasuk says, you should wipe out the males of Amalek. Now, that was his read of the pasuk. Of course, we're going to see where he got that from, but that's part of also what got me thinking over here of the ability of misreading between zecher and zachar, which again, this is clearly a wrong reading of this, and the question that he's then asked, Amar le vaha anan Zecher Karinin. Now we read Zecher. Now some say Zecher, some say Zecher. And there are different versions to commentaries in the Gemara telling you two dots or three dots over here. Omer Le, on a Zecher Karinin. No, but I read Zecher. Azul Shaila the Rabbe. So he goes and asks his teacher. There's actually two ways of reading this. Is it David who goes and asks Yoav's teacher? Or is it Yoav who goes back and asks his teacher? Omer Le, Hecha Kritan. You know, how are we supposed to read this? Omer Le, Zecher, Shakel Safs. By the way, there's also different readings of what he told him over here. I'm saying almost every time that Zayin Kaf Resh is mentioned over here, there's going to be confusion. What should it actually say? He goes, Zecher, Shakel Safs with the Mitkala. He took out his sword. He wanted to kill him. Amar Le Amai. He goes, why do you want to kill me? Amar Le Dichtiv, Arur Osem Elecha Tashem Rumiyah. Cursed should be a person who does the service of God in an inappropriate way or in a deceitful way. So what's interesting over here, first of all, in terms of malpractice of teachers, and how do you treat teachers who taught wrong information along the line? So aside from the class action suit that, you know, one day we're going to do against all the schools and make a lot of money, but aside from that, he's saying is that he wants to kill him because of rabbinic malpractice or teacher malpractice, because it says whoever is deceitful or wrong in his way that he teaches should be cursed. So that his teacher says, Amarle, Shafkale Lahu Gavra Dileikim Barur. Okay, so let's just leave it as cursed. I mean, you don't have to kill me, it says cursed. But then he comes back again, is it Yoav or David? Most likely Yoav. Ktiv, he says, Arur Moneya Charbo Midam. Cursed is the person who doesn't let his sword spill blood. Ikadiyamri Katle, and there's two conclusions of the story. One conclusion is he killed him, Vikadiyamri Lo Katle. And the other conclusion is he didn't kill him. So I guess there's two obvious conclusions over here. Any of you who think I taught something wrong at some point, he clearly did not kill him. I just want you to know that that's clearly going to be the conclusion of the story. But again, this Gemara is really an interesting Gemara. But it's this confusion between Zachar and Zecher or Zachar and Zecher, which I find interesting. And again, I question myself to what extent this may be there in the background of the entire story. So now we just have to decide how much further we can get to today and what else we want to see. It's at this point that we are doing triage. So let's take a look at source 19. 19 are the drashot of the Re Ibn Shu'eb. I really hope I'm pronouncing it properly. I've read him many times. I've cited him many times. I find his comments and commentary completely enthralling. He's, as far as I know, a student of the Rajba, and he's really interesting. Over here he says, Va'od b'midrash, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Now I'll tell you what I was looking for. I was looking for a midrash. I knew that there was a midrash someplace, and I couldn't find it. And he was the one who was closest to the midrash. And the midrash that I'm looking for was quoted by the Malbim in source 20, but Malbim is 19th century, and he's 13th century or 14th century, so therefore this is a much earlier source. And he says it's in a midrash of Shimon B'Yochai, which, by the way, could easily be a Zohar. The problem of sometimes searching the Zohar, then you need to know the Zohar's type of Aramaic to go and search to find the particular thing. I did not get that far, but it's a reasonable assumption that that's what he's talking about, but he says as follows. Va'od b'midrash Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, kevin shiro aviv adom, as soon as Esav is born, he's red. So that was interesting. As soon as he's born, we see, he says he's completely red, and he calls him Esav. And later on, we're given another reason why he's called Edom, because he trades his birthright for the red cholent, as it were. I always assumed it was cholent. And I can't imagine it being anything else, actually. And there's two reasons which are given for his name. So it says, when his father saw that he was red, listen to what it says about Esav. Lo ratza lomolo. He did not want to give him a brit milad. Ad sheyiv lo bodamo. He was afraid that there was some kind of a medical problem with him. You know, today you would say a hemophiliac or something. But he sees this totally red complexion, and he says, oh, there must be some kind of a medical problem with Esav, and therefore he does not do a brit milah at 8 days like Yaakov. And he waits a number of years and he sees his complexion is never changes. Amr kachi briato. V'kevin shelo malti oto l'shmoni yamim emtin ad sheyeh ben yud gimel shanim ki Yishmael. Okay, so I didn't do it at 8 days. Let me at least wait for him to be 13 years old, so he could, you know, like Yishmael out of 13, so we have precedent in the family of doing it at 13. You know, there's stage one and stage two, so, you know, this is the next opportunity. Kevin shegiya l'shlosh esrei shana, but when Esav got to be the age of 13, micha, he protested b'mila v'lo ratza. He said, excuse me, no thank you. No, you're not doing that to me. And that's what it's talking about in that same verse that we had before, is that, oh, you hated blood, which means that Esav himself hated the concept of Brit Milah. So I find this possibility within Midrash so intriguing in terms of everything else that we've seen, which means is that we have Esav as being presented as this anti-hero in the sense of somebody who is the complete opposite of Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael should be a people who are searching for Kedusha. And, you know, I'll say it again. People could be born with different types of capabilities. Now the question is what you do with those capabilities. And even a person who's born with this capability of spilling blood, that person could be a wonderful moel because other people can't. I mean, I've seen too many people who are brave and who are strong and so on and so forth who nonetheless almost faint during a Brit Milah. And including people, by the way, who I know who work within the medical field, but suddenly a Brit Milah, their knees get very wobbly and they turn white. And as I said, I've seen fainting by Brit Milah as well, which is always exciting. And somebody who has this capability of dealing with blood and so on, so there is a way of using Kedusha. And the two ways of Kedusha, which are just presented, are of course the way of being the Moel, or being, I'll say, Shochet / Kohen. I don't mean slash, I guess that's the wrong word to use. So this, that Kohen / Shochet Kohen, to know that kind of service in the Beit HaMikdash. But what we find is that Esav detests this idea. So what this Midrash is really suggesting is that this possibility of using things towards Kedusha don't interest him. And therefore, there's this rejection of Kedusha. And his rejection of Kedusha, therefore, on this Midrashic level, which Rashi likes a lot, is that he rejects, well, he rejected on the one hand to be a Kohen, but later on, Amalek rejects Brit Milah. And those of you who are looking at yourselves, what in the world is this Midrash saying? The rejection of Brit Milah? Yeah, he rejects all kinds of things, including Brit Milah. But how interesting it would be then if the biblical Esav, as said by this Midrash over here, that he himself never had a Brit Milah because it was, again, there was at first supposed medical reasons, but at some point, a protest on his part, say, no, I don't want that type of Kedusha, I don't want that type of life, I don't want that you know, whatsoever. And therefore, it takes us, you know, to this point, after Am Yisrael has already left Egypt, we've did the heavy lifting, we did the hard work, we went through, right? So now, we're about to get to Har Sinai, which will, of course, be the place of holiness, and take upon ourselves all this more holiness. So then it seems to be that not only does Amalek / Edom / Esav reject their own holiness, they don't want us to get the Torah, which means they could have waited and attacked us prior to getting to the land of Israel. They attack us right before we get to Har Sinai. And therefore, you know, they attack us not just by saying, okay, we don't want circumcision. They get upset if we have circumcision. By the way, that again may remind you of certain peoples of the world. They get upset that we have circumcision. We don't want you to have holiness in the world. We don't want you to have any of these things. And why? Because somehow it bothers them on some kind of a core level. As I said, that's this whole other concept which is connected to this Milchemet Amalek. It's the rejection of holiness. And therefore, who are the easiest ones to attack? The Jews who are weaker. The Jews who themselves have some sort of ambiguity or in terms of their connection with holiness. So they're the ones who, of course, the message of Amalek is going to resonate the most with, and they're the ones that we need to protect the most. They're the ones we need to make sure that they have more of access to Kedusha. They have more of access to things of holiness, which means that the very idea of the Mechemet Amalek is to attack Amalek's attack against holiness. And of course, the best way of attacking an attack against holiness is by trying to create a world which has a lot more holiness.